This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, thank you so much for coming. It's always so nice to see such a full group. Oh, and yes, we have some folks online. Would some of you like to say your names, introduce yourselves briefly?
Hi, Kiba.
Hello, I'm Joel.
I'm Susan.
Peter.
Welcome. It's wonderful to have such a big group. For how many of you, maybe you could just raise your hand, is this your first time at Jikoji? Both a nice mix of first-time people and people who have been here for a while. A few things that I thought I might talk about today. Our practice here at Jikoji, like all Zen practice, is the practice of the middle way. Middle way is the path that avoids extremes. Most of you will know the story of Buddha's life, that he was born as a prince, born in what is now Nepal, and lived in what is now India. And his parents made every effort to shelter him, pamper him, try to protect him from all suffering. And so for the first two decades of his life, he led this existence of sort of extreme comfort, trying to avoid any hardship, any suffering. And as much as he enjoyed that, and it does sound pleasant, he found it unsatisfying, unfulfilling. And as this sense of unease grew, he escaped from this palace, ventured with a servant into the neighboring village, and saw what we call the three sights. First, someone who was very sick. Then someone who was very old, and finally a funeral procession carrying someone who had died. And with this realization of sickness, old age, and death, he knew he couldn't go back to the palace and living a life of pure luxury. And then he saw what we call the fourth sight, a wandering holy man dressed in rags, as was common in India in those days, and we still see today, and decided to set off on the spiritual path. So having tried this life of pleasure, he then thought the logical thing was to try the opposite and tried to live a life of extreme hardship, trying all sorts of ascetic practices, holding his breath for long periods, starving himself for long periods. Mm-hmm. He had this sense that by pushing his body to these limits, that must be the way to overcome suffering. But what he found was that this didn't work either. That by pushing himself in this way, torturing himself in this way, he only suffered more, but didn't really come to any greater understanding. So he found a quiet place to sit in meditation, and vowed to just sit until he had finally found the answer to this riddle of suffering. And it was around this time of year we usually mark in early December when he had this experience. But he sat all through the night and into the early hours of the morning. When he saw the morning star, he had his great awakening and realized that the path to overcome suffering was not to avoid it at all costs and not to invite it all the time, but a middle path. Path of accepting suffering, confronting suffering when it arises, neither inviting nor avoiding, but staying firmly in the center. And although that sounds simple enough, it's quite difficult to do. We somehow seem to have this natural tendency to veer towards these extremes. I like to think that our practice here at Jokoji reflects this middle way. We have a certain amount of formality. Teachers like myself often wear these robes. We have this brief service in the morning. We do some bows. We sit with an upright posture. But not too much formality. Our founding teacher, Kobenchino Odagawa Roshi, always had a sort of relaxed manner to him. Although he also wore robes and performed services like I did this morning, he wore these things lightly. Using these rituals as just opportunities to practice. Opportunities to be mindful, opportunities to pay attention. Because that's really the key. The middle path in life is often elusive. We're very unlikely to stumble upon it by accident. We have to look for it. And to look for it, we have to pay attention. And the practice of meditation, what we've been doing this morning, what we do every day here at the temple, it can be very helpful in developing this skill of attention. The practice of Zazen, of sitting meditation, is in many ways the purest practice of attention. Because in those moments, we're literally not trying to do anything else. Our only task is to sit, to breathe, and to be present. to pay attention to that simple act of existing. And the hope is that if we can pay attention in those moments, that we can pay attention in every other moment, that we can carry that skill of attention with us, no matter what we're doing, no matter where we are. Life is not always easy. And so our lives are filled with blissful moments, peaceful moments, but also difficult moments, challenging moments. And our practice is to confront them all head on. Not to run away from the difficult moments, as Buddha did for those first decades, but also not to run away from the pleasant moments, as Buddha did as an ascetic. But to experience them all, to notice them all, pay attention to them all. Buddhist talks are filled with lists. After he had his great awakening, after some time, he decided to become a teacher. And his teaching style was designed to be easy to remember, because he lived, you know, not just before screens and technology, but before any means of recording what was said, including even before paper. And so if he wanted people to remember his teachings, they literally had to remember them. So he had a few different techniques. He often spoke in verse, which seems to be easier for people to remember than prose. But he also used lots of lists. One of these lists was what he called the three essential elements of existence, the three things that you see everywhere you look. And those were, in the language they come to us, anicca, impermanence, dukkha, suffering, anatta, no self. Impermanence, suffering, and no self. In a way, I've talked already about suffering. It is just a fact of life. You can try to avoid it for a while, as he did try, but it eventually catches up with us. But although that tends to be the part of that list that's talked about the most, I find myself most fascinated by the first item, impermanence, change. And it's easy to forget this reality, this fact of life, this core element of existence. It's easy to forget that everything changes. The last time I spoke up here, I haven't been up so often this fall. It was very, very hot. And so when I was packing my robes this morning, of course, I packed my lightest robes. Forgetting that seasons change. It's not hot up here anymore. Again, a little bit like our tendency to veer from one extreme to the other, I think we have a tendency to assume that things will stay the same, that the world we remember from a few months ago, or even yesterday, or even just a moment before, is the same world we'll face now. And it can be unsettling to realize that's not the case. To realize that everything changes. And it can be frightening. Sometimes we find ourselves going through life trying to avoid change in the same way that Buddha and his parents tried avoiding suffering. And yet I think we're probably even less successful at that. The truth is, you can kind of avoid suffering for a little while. You can escape somewhere. Take a vacation. Just stop thinking about your problems. And you can maybe avoid suffering for a day or even a week, maybe longer. In a sort of denial. But it's much, much harder to deny change. Because it really is right in front of us all the time. Sitting in meditation in Zazen, as we did this morning, it's a wonderful opportunity to experience that. We can go through a broad spectrum of feelings and emotions, sensations. We might have moments of sitting where we feel very peaceful, moments where we feel very impatient, moments where we're comfortable, moments where our bodies start to hurt. And we talk about these periods of meditation in a sort of shorthand. We talk about sitting for 40 minutes or 30 minutes or just maybe 10 minutes. But the truth is, you can't really sit for 40 minutes or 30 minutes or 10 minutes. That's not how we actually experience meditation. All we can really do is sit for a single moment and try to give that moment a full attention. And then we can do that again for the next moment. And then we can do that again for the next moment. And there's no way to know what each moment will bring. The only certainty is that each one is a little different. Whatever you're feeling right now.
Hola. ¿Cómo están?
Una nueva persona.
Thank you.
Ella se llama Margarita.
Music television.
I don't know.
Esperanza se fue. Un mes que se fue.
Whatever we're feeling in each moment, all we can be certain of is that we'll feel something different.
Margarita.
Sí, ha estado viniendo conmigo.
Whatever you're feeling right now.
Está.
Happy or sad.
No,
energized,
no.
Restless, sleepy.
Viernes, sábado y domingo no trabaja.
¿Cómo se llama otra vez?
Selina.
Selina.
In the next moment, you may be feeling something else entirely.
Okay. Está, no doble esas, pero de todos modos para ponerlas ahora.
I do think once we realize that, once we realize
cada domingo, porque
a change is the only guarantee,
so,
it does become a little less frightening.
Entonces, aunque es muy poco, ahora está
bien. Hay que sacarlo.
Sí.
Okay.
When we realize that it's impossible to avoid change,
aquí cuando se desestancia, poner los barriles,
in a sense that gives us permission to stop fighting it, to stop trying to avoid it.
La línea roja.
Roja.
Más adelante.
Sí, para dejar más espacio para carros que no tienen más.
Present in this moment.
Es rojo.
Pero mejor grasping it too hard.
Yes. En verdad, la policía.
Not trying to make this moment more than it is.
No
hace nada.
Not trying to make this moment last forever.
Ya, ya. Sí,
más, no al extremo, pero más allá.
Okay.
Donde, okay. Antes de que curva.
I think it makes it easier to think about endings.
Vamos a trabajar entonces.
Okay.
Endings can feel quite difficult.
Ya conoce ahora a Margarita, ¿eh?
Uh-huh.
Ella va a estar viniendo siempre.
Bueno.
Whether it's the end.
Es más fácil quitar.
A job. A friendship. A relationship.
Construyó.
Espérame.
Life.
No, para canasta.
Para el sucio.
No, para lo colgado limpio.
Ah.
Para lo que está colgado.
Ok.
But of course, the truth is that everything ends.
It's
not a question of if.
Gracias. It's
a question of when.
Sí.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
at least for me, I think that makes it a little easier.
Hay bananos y manzanas aquí, pero ustedes saben dónde están en la cocina, ¿no?
We let go of this expectation of permanence.
We
don't have to be surprised or disappointed. We're confronted with an ending. In a sense, we always knew it was coming.
Una pina así como esta, una canasta así.
We just didn't know exactly when.
Lo que tenemos que hacer aquí es armar este aparato y colgarlos aquí.
¿Están mojados todavía esos tapetes?
No, ya están secos.
Bueno,
ya están secos, ya.
Muy bien.
And all those these things are in some ways not that difficult to explain. It isn't really enough to hear them said. In Buddha's time, there are lots of stories about people listening to Buddha's talks and having a spontaneous awakening. But that doesn't seem to happen anymore. It's not clear if that's because Perhaps Buddha was just a much better teacher than our teachers of today. Or maybe students were somehow better prepared, closer to awakening on their own. Or, of course, it's very possible that those stories are just exaggerated after so many centuries. But it seems today it's not enough to hear someone talk about these things. We have to experience them for ourselves. And Buddha himself advised his students not to trust anything just because somebody said it, but to put their faith in their own experience. And the way we experience these truths is through this practice of meditation.
¿Y Mari? ¿Dónde está Mari?
People sometimes worry in meditation.
Pensé que no vino.
No, he vino, sí,
oh. Feel like an escape, like running away. It is really the opposite of that. Running away was what Buddha was doing before he discovered meditation. And he was trying to avoid suffering at all costs. Meditation is the practice of trying to see the world exactly as it is, to experience each moment exactly as it is. Not to run away from anything. To confront reality head on. And I think when we do that, when we make the effort to see the world as it is, we do see this truth of change. It can sometimes feel in our lives like nothing is changing. It can even feel that during a long period of meditation. But I think when we have those feelings, the truth is that we're not paying attention. We've allowed our minds to drift. Perhaps we've fallen asleep. Because when we're truly awake, when we're truly present, when we're noticing each moment as it occurs, change is undeniable. We feel it, we see it, we experience it. It's a little like how from a distance snowflakes look alike, but when you really look at them closely, they're all very different. When we're not really paying attention, many of life's moments can look alike. But when we really examine them closely, we see that they're all different. Perhaps you're experiencing bigger change in your life. Sometimes these bigger changes are what bring people to practice. Changes in your relationships, in your jobs, in your sense of self. But whether you're experiencing big changes or the small everyday changes of each moment, I hope you'll take advantage of the opportunity to notice the change, pay attention to it, confront it, embrace it. It's a wonderful opportunity to hone our attention, focus our attention. It's a wonderful opportunity for practice. And that's really what we're doing here at this temple. Been around now more than 40 years. And we hope to have it for 400 more. We follow Buddha's example of sitting quietly. Experiencing each moment. And realizing this middle way. Taking a break from our busy lives. And trying for these moments just to practice attention. Just to sit. And breathe and be here together. It's a great gift to practice in a group like this, at a temple like this. I'm always grateful to see so many people come. And there are so many other things you could be doing on a beautiful Sunday. So I hope you found our time of practicing together beneficial. For those of you coming for the first time, I hope you'll come back. For those who have been here many times, I hope you'll come back too. Maybe with that, I'll open things up a little for questions before we all have lunch together. You can ask about what I've been talking about, or you can actually ask about anything else you'd like to ask about. Yes.
When you're talking, you mentioned that suffering can be avoided for a short period of time through denial or avoidance. But do you think that may be another form of suffering in itself, kind of self-imposed? I remember my own experiences and think that those are the times when the suffering is the worst, because you know that you're not moving forward. You're, in fact, letting it grow and letting it kind of fester. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I think it's a tricky question. And I certainly wouldn't want to encourage anyone to live in denial. But at least my experience, both for myself and people around me, is that you can live in denial for a little bit. Mm-hmm. pretty successfully. I mean, I think we all probably know people who are in terrible jobs or terrible relationships or other kinds of bad situations and are just not admitting it to themselves and are just somehow powering through. I think the thing is just that you can't do it forever. Mm-hmm. Eventually reality catches up. And maybe this is part of what you're asking, that sometimes when it catches up, it's much worse than if you had just dealt with it, you know, at the beginning. That in the same way, you know, you can get a cut on your arm, let's say, and just ignore it and pretend it's not there and probably be okay for a little while. But if you really don't do anything, eventually you get an infection. It gets much worse than if you just dealt with it right away. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's a good strategy, but it is possible. And it's something you see people doing all the time. I'm a parent, although my kids are grown now. But I see that same temptation that Buddhist parents had to want to shelter my kids, protect them from anything that might make them sad or cause them to suffer. And you can sort of do it for a little while. You can, you know, try really, really hard and try to keep them from experiencing difficult things. But again, you just can't do it forever. Eventually, they are faced with the same reality that Buddha was faced with, that we're all faced with. So I'm certainly not suggesting it's a good strategy or one that in the long run reduces anyone's suffering. But in a sense, if it wasn't possible to live in denial, you know, we wouldn't need to practice because we'd all just be living in the moment. But in fact, many people aren't and are living in some sort of make-believe.
How did you manage to stay in one pose that not feel uncomfortable? Because when I do the meditation, I feel like I have to change the position.
Although you're assuming I don't feel uncomfortable. you know, to me, it gets back to what I was saying about change. And every moment is different. You know, when I sit, there are moments that are very comfortable and there are moments that are much less comfortable. And when I'm feeling uncomfortable, I notice that I'm feeling uncomfortable. When I'm feeling comfortable, I notice that I'm feeling comfortable. At some point, I might decide that it's too uncomfortable. You know, I don't want to injure myself and I don't want you to injure yourself. But at other times I feel it's okay. And I'll just see what comes next. So right now, for example, my left foot has fallen asleep. And I've noticed that. And it's sort of uncomfortable. But that's all it is. And I know because I've done this many times that when we're done and it's time to stand up, I'll need to stand up slowly because if I stand up too fast, I'll fall over. That'll be very uncomfortable. but if I stand up slowly, it'll be fine. My foot will wake up and I'll walk over and have lunch. I do think almost everything in life gets easier with practice. And so it is easier for me to sit in this upright posture now than it was when I was first learning. And your body adjusts and your joints and muscles adjust to you. And you can do things like stretch and help your body adjust. But some of it is also maybe that I'm I'm more comfortable with being uncomfortable than I was when I started, because I know it won't last forever. And I know, at least in my case, it doesn't seem to do any real damage. And so even if I feel a little uncomfortable now, I know that I won't later. And so I don't worry about it too much.
And then you certainly draw a crowd. It's an interesting part of it was for me at one point the same. I attended a meditation retreat with you, and you brought up Jikoji, and this brought me up here, and your teachings and your books that you wrote has certainly helped me and was a big influence on my journey to meditation. So I want to thank you for this part. So my question is, on the list that you mentioned on the beginning, you had three topics on it. You had impermanence on it, you had suffering on it, and you had no self on it. So it's something I currently exploring, no self, non-dualism, and you didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. So if you would mind, maybe a bit.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. You know, to me, all three of these things, impermanent suffering and no self, in some ways, they're all the same. They're all just different ways of talking about the same thing. No self in particular. One way to think about it is to ask, what would it mean if there was a self? So what is the alternative to saying there isn't one? So the alternative to saying there isn't one is there is one. So what would that mean? What would that self be? And I think for most of us, what we think of is that there's some separate, unchanging core that defines us. And so, you know, when you look back at your life, there's some essence that's always there, that's coming with you. I spent last week with my older daughter. She's 23. She's living on her own, and so I went and was with her for a week. And it's interesting because I remember so clearly being 23, and I think of the 23-year-old me as me, as the same person. You know, I can draw a line from that person to now. That wasn't so true when my kids were like 3 or 4 or 6, because even if I remember being 6, I don't feel like I'm that 6-year-old. But I sort of still feel like I'm that 23-year-old. That's really around when I started practicing. But what does it mean to say I'm that same person? It means that there's something that hasn't changed between then and now. But as I was talking about today, there's nothing that doesn't change. There's no thing that was present then that's present now unchanged. And so when we talk about there being no self, we don't mean that we don't exist. I mean, we clearly do exist. And Buddha understood that we exist. He used, you know, first person pronouns. He talked about I, when I experience this, when I experience that. You know, he understood that he was a person and that he was addressing people who were real. But what we mean is that there's no permanent, unchanging essence. You know, if you were to go into an operating room and they would open you up, there's no you inside there that's the same you that they would have found 10 years ago or even yesterday. There's just a bunch of parts that are always changing and always evolving. And so there's nothing more than just each of these moments. And so to me, the no self is just a natural in a sense, corollary or conclusion from understanding that everything changes. And, you know, at the time, this was a somewhat radical idea because, I mean, even today, many faiths hold that there is some essential, unchanging, permanent thing inside us. Maybe thing is not quite the right word, but essence, something. And Buddha said, you know, there's just, how could that be? For that to be true, then there would have to be something that doesn't change. And as far as he was able to tell, he just never found anything that didn't change. Nothing was immune. And so just like I was saying about how everything changes, everything has an end, whether that's a job, a relationship, or even a life, well, that's true of us as well. And it is a little frightening and strange. But even so, I think there's nothing to be gained by denying it, because eventually reality catches up. So again, we can live in a denial of this fact that there's no unchanging permanent self, and maybe take some comfort in that. But eventually we're faced with the reality of that change, whether it's by noticing ourselves getting older, or sometimes it's easier to notice that in the people around us. So that's my understanding.
My dad.
Can you kind of like walk through just like what does it mean to live the middle path? And then I guess like my understanding is like to embrace both suffering and kind of the enjoyment or the pleasure. And then I guess the part that like I kind of struggle with is like we are individual, there is the self, right? And we have this pursuit or desires or whatnot. And so that will steer us towards either like pain or pleasure. And so how does that reconcile with like living the middle path?
Well, one thing I should say is that the middle path looks different for everybody. And so my middle path will look different than yours. You know, some people might look at me and say, okay, he gets up every morning and meditates. You know, that seems kind of extreme. But, you know, for example, monastics who are living in a temple all the time might look at my life and say, oh, he's like veered way over towards, you know, pleasure and ease. He needs more discipline in his life. So you do have to find the middle path for yourself. And to pay attention to when you find yourself, in a sense, trying too hard to avoid suffering, or being too hard on yourself and inviting too much suffering. And try to find that balance. You know, at some level, there's nothing wrong. I don't know, sort of common sense. You know, this stove right now is quite hot because it's been burning all morning. So, you know, we probably shouldn't touch it. That's just going to invite needless suffering. So even as I like, you know, walk by, I'm going to try to avoid brushing against the stove, because that's just needless suffering that's not going to help anybody. But there's other suffering in life. You know, my father passed away this summer. to some extent, I can avoid that by just not thinking about it, you know, trying to just maybe pretend that it didn't happen. That's probably a bad kind of avoiding suffering, because he did pass away. And eventually, I will have to confront that. And so while I never have to touch the stove, I do have to deal with certain kinds of suffering in my life, and putting that off or pretending that I don't isn't going to accomplish anything. And so you really have to answer these questions for yourself about when are we just being sort of sensible and avoiding suffering that's not sort of unnecessary and optional and isn't really serving any purpose? And when are we living in denial and avoiding suffering that actually we kind of need to just face and deal with? That's only going to get worse if we try to avoid it. Our lives these days are very complicated and often involve juggling lots of things. You know, I'm what Buddha called a householder monk, priest, meaning I have a family and a job and all those things, in addition to my practice. And Buddha wasn't against people doing that, having complicated lives. He just thought it was really difficult and thought it was much easier to just go become a monk or a nun and not engage in the world in all these complicated ways. He thought of that as the easy path. He thought what most of us are doing, probably all of us are doing, as the really difficult path. You know, as hard as it is to pay attention when we practice Zazen, it is easier than it is out in the world. And that's why we do it. We do it because it's a way to kind of isolate that muscle and make it strong. And so in the same way, it's easier to practice in a very simple, constrained environment of just a faraway temple. And it's much harder to practice in the world, as I'm sure you're doing, as I'm doing, as I think we're all doing. But as difficult as it is, it's possible. Possible to bring our attention to these daily tasks, these daily choices, and to find our own middle way. And even after we found it, to keep looking for it, because it moves, or we move, and it shifts. You know, the middle way for me looks different now than it did when my kids were very young, when I was just starting in my career, or when I was married. And so I have to keep looking for it. And in a way, you know, we find a new middle path in every moment. The key is just to keep looking.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.